Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Moderator ID accepted.
The number you have reached, 774-4321, in area code 207, is not in service. Please check the number and dial again. The number you have reached, 774-4321, in area code 207, is not in service. Please check the number and dial again. The number you have reached, 774-4321, in area code 207, is not in service. Please check the number and dial again. The number you have reached, 774-4321, in area code 207, is not in service. Please check the number and dial again. The number you have reached, 774-4321, in area code 207, is not in service. Please check the number and dial again. The number you have reached, 774-4321, in area code 207, is not in service. Please check the number and dial again.
Mary? Hello, Mary, are you there? Mary, I'm online. Are you there?
Hi, Carolyn.
Hey, look, we did it. This is awesome,
Yes, this is very awesome. Good. Terrific. Yay!
That was a brilliant idea, whatever it was. And also, I have no idea how to turn off my call forwarding, but nobody ever calls me, so I'm going to assume nobody will call me. So we'll just go from there.
That's right. If it happens, you know, we'll just deal with it. That's all.
Yep.
It'll be fine. It'll just beep, beep, beep a few times, and then it'll go away, right?
Yep. Yep.
That's how that works. Yeah. And, I learned about the emergency number because of getting booted off my call last time with Kate Clinton. So I made sure I got an emergency number to have on hand. So I'm glad that worked. Okay. So, let's just sort of talk through our process and let me answer any questions you have about this so that you're good and clear. So I'm going to do an intro to the event, and then I'm going to intro you, which is reading your short bio, and then we'll go right into questions. And then you have a piece to read.
Yes.
Okay.
And, I do, and it's about, I think it's about 30 minutes.
Okay. Okay. So how would you like to, I'd like to have a few questions before we go into you reading and then finish up with questions, right?
Yeah, that works fine for me.
Okay. And is there anything, any question in particular you want me to use to tee up what you're going to read? Or
I noticed the word clit is in my piece, and I want to know if you have any, if that's a problem with your broadcast.
I don't have a problem with it.
I'm so glad you don't have a problem with your clit, Mary. That makes me feel so good.
it's a recognized body part.
Well, I'm pretty up on FCC because I do a lot of radio stuff, but I'm thinking I don't really know what the deal is with this deal, so.
Okay. Right. Well, So, why, have you had other times when you've recorded that you can't use words of that sort?
Oh, FCC only. I mean, it's radio. This is a podcast, so it probably is a very different thing. I just thought I would ask. Or maybe, you know, if you weren't comfortable with it in your programming.
Here's one of the benefits of doing this ahead of time. Every day at the beginning of the day, I will send out an email that promos the calls for the day. And because I've pre-recorded them, I can actually write a pretty accurate description of the call and sort of what I think are the hot points about the call. So I can just make a note in the email that the C word, the CL word is used. And
I wouldn't do that. Lesbians probably wouldn't. It's mostly, you know, like, I mean, I can get radio shows in big trouble, you know, if I.
Yeah.
And that's just like shit. And, I mean, there's a bunch of things you can't say on radio. You know, I just thought I'd ask. I'd just let it go then. It's fine.
But I don't have a problem with it. I mean, apart from that, I'm staying away from, you know, lots of cursing and swearing on these calls.
No problem, not at all. So that was my only question. I'm good.
Okay, great. All right. So let's see. I got a couple different things I got to do at the same time here. I have a timer I'm going to run. So I'm going to run the timer for from the start of the recording for 50 minutes. So it'll go off, and my goal is to then end the call in the next 5 to 6 minutes. So we're just under an hour for the call, okay?
Okay, yep.
All right, so I'm going to start the recording. Have I got my thing here? I got my thing. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this session of the Live Your Best Lesbian Life Telesummit. I'm thrilled that you're all here this morning, and I'm thrilled that our special guest, Carolyn Gage, is here. My name is Mary Nelia with GayGirlDatingCoach.com, and I'm your host for this event. The purpose of this summit is to provide you, to provide women across the U.S. and beyond with the opportunity to learn from women who are living their amazing lesbian lives out loud. And Carolyn is certainly one of those women. Women who are role models for not just getting by, but women who live amazing lives doing something they are truly passionate about. Women who have created life by their own rules and are making important and positive impacts on our communities, on being lesbian, being out, being loud and proud about those things. And one of those women is Carolyn Gage. Now, I met Carolyn Gage right when I was coming out about 12 years ago, and so she really was somebody who impacted me in some pretty big ways at that point in my life and really helped me in that redefining process of having been living in the heterosexual world and married and coming out in my 40s to really redefine myself as lesbian. But let me tell you a little bit more about Carolyn and how she's living her amazing lesbian life out loud. She is a lesbian feminist playwright, performer, director, and an activist. She's the author of 9 books on lesbian theater and 65 plays, musicals, and one-woman shows. She specializes in non-traditional roles for women, especially those that are about reclaiming famous lesbians whose stories have been distorted or erased from history. Carolyn, hello, good morning, and thank you for being here today.
Oh, I'm happy to do it.
One of the things I really like that you stated in your bio is this reclaiming famous lesbians whose stories have been distorted or erased. So who are those famous lesbians that you're sort of rewriting the stories about?
Oh, boy, there's a lot of them, and most of them have ended up in plays that I've written, or many of them have, and they would include Joan of Arc and Jane Addams, Ava LaGallienne, she was an actor, also Nance O'Neill, an actor, and the Chiricahua Warrior, Lausanne, just many, many, many lesbians, and then some that are just sort of regionally well-known, like Cornelia Crosby, who was the first Maine hunting guide here in Maine. All kinds of women, and lots of women that you might not have known were lesbian.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the piece that's really interesting is, you know, you're sleuthing around and sort of pulling back the covers on these stories that have really been hidden or distorted, as you use the term, by history and by men who've written books about history and the brief mentions of women who've made a difference in the world. And how have you really found these women? What have been the clues for you that made them stand out as obviously they were lesbians and living in whatever period that they were, a very different lifestyle than the average woman?
Well, you know, it is a little bit of a detective work type of thing, and often they are women who are in traditionally male fields, like the first Maine hunting guide, and in the 19th century that was definitely not something women did, partly because they wore long skirts, Jane Addams and her, you know, very pioneering work, considering that she was a woman of privilege, what she chose to do, and much of her work was very centered on women. So you look for non-traditional, work, and also work that advocates powerfully for women. And very often it turns out these are women with same-sex relationships and affinities.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. As I had mentioned introducing you, that you and I met back about 12 years ago when I was first coming out, and you and I were both sort of looking for the same thing, how to build some community and meet some women and develop some friendships and relationships in the area that where we live, Portland, Maine. And so you shared with me this concept of the lesbian salon, and we came up with the concept of the lesbian salon of art and ideas, I did that for, I don't know, well, maybe over a year. And one of the first things that happened was you came in and read one of your pieces, which was about this woman who was a guide here in the state of Maine. It was really, is it Parmentini Bell? Is that what it was called?
The Parmentini Bell, yeah. Yeah. That's the name of a kind of famous regional fly. But it also kind of refers to the woman herself.
Mm-hmm. It was really a wonderful experience. And actually, in a little bit, Carolyn's going to share one of her pieces for us today. So, Carolyn, in your work, as particularly from the perspective of the lesbian feminist playwright and activist, you know, one of the things that that we can see as we sort of look across the landscape is that the representation of lesbians in the mainstream is more scarce compared to that of gay men. Why do you think that is?
I think that it's a mistake to sort of feel like lesbians and gay men are just sort of, you know, different flavors of the same thing. I mean, there's ways in which that's true. But the bottom line is that we live in a male-dominated, very patriarchal culture. And that culture, I think people tend to forget, has always been homosocial. In this country, we've had a history until very recently of all-male governments, all-male juries in the 19th century, all-male universities, all-male businesses, and all-male military. So men are pretty comfortable with men associating with men. The sexual piece is new and radical, and it's a good thing those barriers are coming down. But when you look at lesbian culture, it's about women reserving primary intimacy for other women. That means, you know, their domestic services, their sexual services. We tend to not share those with men. And often lesbians do move in all-female organizations or do advocacy for women's causes. And that is a completely different thing. As I say, gay male culture is homosocial, as is patriarchy. So they don't have that sort of rude awakening. And often I find with audiences, when it's a play about women who are all about women's business, that there's a certain consternation that the men are having difficulty finding a cultural referent to access the work. It's like, well, where am I in this? And they never ask when we're watching a bunch of patriarchal films or movies that women are sitting there like, where am I in this? It's like, well, that's your place, you know? So that inequality bothers me. It's like, the assumption that male culture is universal, but women's culture is some special subculture or something. That's really annoying. But I think that the fact it's a patriarchal culture is what the difference is.
It's really interesting. I really find the image of, you know, we live in this homosocial society where for years and years and years everything has been male-dominated. Governments male-dominated, the military, the judicial, business, universities. It's like, yeah, it's really true. And you start to look at it across the spectrum, and that women in that patriarchal society, we've had a different role. Lesbians break out of it in some way, but sort of by doing this counterculture, we'll do our own thing over here. Do you think that women, you know, you're talking about this sort of homosocial culture, that women tend to, because we're doing this sort of reserving intimacy with women and moving in all-female circles, that our circles tend to be a little more fractured, smaller, less reaching out across?
Well, I think and also sports is another thing that until really, you know, the 20th century was pretty close to women. Men learn male bonding, you know, and they have always mm-hmm. historically learned it. They've learned it at their father's knee, and they've learned it in the military, or they've learned it in playing sports. And I think for women, we've learned, you know, to be very distrustful and compete with each other. In a patriarchal culture, often, sadly, we learned it from our mothers. And many mothers still, if they have to choose between allegiance to their husband or their boyfriend and their children, sadly, often they will choose the boyfriend. And that's a powerful lesson for girls, realizing, you know, stick with the man. And privilege the relationship to the male over that of your female friends. And I think that's, if you learn that at your mother's knee, it's a very difficult template to replace, because it's almost hardwired in that women are distrustful and not to be trusted. And that's, you know, like you think of, you know, who did the binding of little girls' feet in China, in ancient China, and who is performing the clitorectomies on the girls, the millions of them that still happen. And it's the female relatives. It's the mothers and the aunties. And, boy, you know, when you have that kind of trauma inflicted by, you know, your female caregiver, guardian, birth mother, it's, what are you learning? And the associations of pain and torture with your most trusted caregiver is very, lots of crazy-making, horrendous mixed messages that we receive from women in patriarchal cultures growing up.
But yeah, that's really, really interesting, that whole sort of women are forced in these certain cultures to perpetrate against young women in those ways. It's really sad. So out of that, you know, this women learning, you know, to not trust other women. We're not safe. It's extremely competitive because, even I think within the lesbian community, you see that sort of competition one against the other versus support or trust or even, you know, the term of that male bonding. It's like, yeah, you know, we're out here to win, but we're going to win as a team kind of thing. And that women, I mean, growing up for me, that was not what I was taught. And being a mother of a soon-to-be 18-year-old daughter who's been very active in sports, I'm still not sure that she's really, there's been this we support each other bonding thing. I see as much competition and a don't trust each other happening in her world as I might see in my own world, being in my 50s, looking around and trying to connect and build community, relationship, business with other women.
Well, that's interesting.
So, Carolyn, you have, you know, spent many, many years of your life writing plays and musicals and traveling, bringing your plays and your works across the country and overseas. And what's your experience as far as lesbian theaters and the availability of, or the ease of, like, producing your work and getting it out in the world?
Very difficult. And I have found that there's just, there's so many reasons for that. And, you know, part of it, of course, again, is, you know, misogyny and that sort of thing. But also there's difficulty within our own lesbian cultures, which has been difficult because I see lesbians flocking to women's choruses and they flock to line dancing in the 90s and they flock to the bookstores. But theater, not so much. And I think maybe because theater tells a story, and it's always a very gendered story. It's bodies on the stage. They're either male or they're female bodies. And I find that, you know, women historically on the stage have been rewards or obstacles for men, and, you know, lesbians, of course, aren't in that narrative and are oppressed by it. So I don't feel like it's really an art form that we grew up appreciating for the most part. And then, of course, if you want to produce theater, it's expensive. It is very, very labor intensive, and the end product has a short shelf life. It's not a film. You can't put it in the can. And so it's, you know, I think that's difficult. And then if you go another layer deeper, it's like a military maneuver. You've got 15 people, and at 8 o'clock on Friday night, Saturday night, they have to all be in the same place, in the same costumes. doing exactly the same thing night after night is a precision that's almost military, and it requires that level of hierarchy and discipline. People have to show up. They have to make the rehearsals. You can't just call in and take a mental health day. And then there's somebody telling you what to do, and, of course, we do love that as lesbians, don't we? So I found that, being a lesbian director is really kind of a setup for every projected animosity in the universe. But I think that those things make it difficult. Lesbians tend to gravitate more towards the drum circle or the women's chorus or things that are not quite so, like military maneuvers. And then also I think there's a lot of internalized things that come up. For example, the butch woman is really at risk in patriarchy. She's often a target in a way that a more feminine lesbian isn't. And I have found, much of my work is butch-centric, I have found that a lot of lesbian butches, first off, they lack any training in theater because they're treated so hideously in mainstream. They're rarely cast for anything. And then they get up on stage and they're supposed to, you know, really have their story front and center. It kicks up a lot of things because they've survived by kind of keeping their head down and moving forward. And not being in the spotlight. So, yeah, there are just a myriad of reasons why I think it's a difficult mix, lesbians and theater. And I also think that live theater is one of the most powerful mediums for social change that there is, and that's one of the reasons we need to just forge ahead and figure out how to do it.
So, talk to me then about, you have a project you've been working on for a long time, the Butch Visibility Project.
The Butch Visibility Project is kind of an initiative to try to call attention. You know, sometimes you don't notice what's missing because it's missing. And to really have people begin to notice who's missing in the canon and also what happens when the so-called masculine woman or the butch woman, or especially the butch lesbian, is missing on the stage. Like, how does that skew the whole spectrum of roles for women and the whole culture for women that we're seeing represented when that woman is not allowed to even be present or visible? So I'm trying to raise awareness about that, and then I have an enormous number of plays that feature butch characters, and so those are cataloged one-acts, comedies, historical plays, so that people can access them easily depending on what kind of production they're looking to do. But I feel it's a real affirmative action move, the Butch Visibility Project. There is if you go to my website, on the splash page, there's a link to the Butch Visibility Project, and I have a very short 20-minute YouTube video about the project and about the historical erasure of the butch.
And your website is carolyngage.com.
Yeah, pretty easy to find.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Who do you look at, or who do you consider to be role models for you in the work that you're doing, and how you sort of defined yourself over the years? Who do you look to?
Well, in some of these I've played. I think, you know, for 20-some years, I've retired the piece now, but I performed the role of Joan of Arc as a 19-year-old lesbian and very militant. And that, I think it really began to shape my character, actually, because I played it so frequently and I was so identified with it. But also, like, I've just completed a musical about Babe Diedrichsen, and she was a tremendous role model for me because, of course, she was trying to break into the boys' club of professional sports, and she tried to do it six ways to Sunday as the exceptional woman, which is what they want us all to think we are. And she finally figured it out, and she got together with other women and formed the LPGA, because the exceptional woman is a trap, as, you know, most of us will learn. So I feel like, just studying her life and the way her career went has really helped me, because I've encountered so many times the same dynamics, and particularly with this musical. It's a very big, expensive, full book musical. And it's very much a boys' club. The kind of the folks who have the kind of money to put on a musical on Broadway, that is a boys club of a boys club. So it's very interesting taking this play into that arena. I feel like I'm walking with bleeding footsteps down the path that she trod in sports, and I'm doing it in musical theater. So she's been a real role model for me.
Well, that's great. Now we started to talk about some of your actual plays and work, and you're gonna do a reading for us. So tell me about that.
Well, I am in an alter ego. I am Sister Carolyn, and I've organized this kind of forum for my sermons, and that's the Sisterhood of the Sacred Synapse. I feel like women need to be thinking deeply and radically, those of us who still can. And so I actually sort of invented this sort of sacred sisterhood where we consider thinking to be a sacrament. That's the sacred synapse. We take thinking very seriously. We treat it as a sacrament. And it's a little bit of a joke, and when I'm being Sister Carolyn, it's a little bit of a comedy act, but it's also kind of dead serious radical feminist politic, because I do feel that of all the things we're suffering from on this planet, the top of the list is a colossal failure of feminist imagination. And that is something you can do all alone in your room. That is something that we can all do. And I feel like we need to take that seriously as an obligation. It's a prerogative and an obligation. So anyway, what I'm going to share with you is taken from one of the Lesbian Tent Revival sermons from the Sisterhood of the Sacred Synapse, and it is called The Other L Words. And it's a little bit of a radical look at relationships, the politics of relationships.
Oh, I can't wait. Let's start it.
Tell me when to start.
Right now.
Well, all right. Okay. Everybody ready?
I'm ready. We're ready.
Okay. All right. This is The Other L Words. And today my talk is titled The Other L Words, and these are two words beginning with L, and they aren't lesbian, but they have a lot to do with our lesbian relationships, which is why I'm wanting to talk about them. One of them you probably have never heard of, and the other one you have heard of way too much. And there's a reason for this. There's a connection between why you've never heard of one of these words and why you've heard way too much of the other. A connection. And a connection in the brain is another word for the synapse. So listen up, synapse with me, and maybe we'll save ourselves a lot of money on those U-Haul rentals. This is going to be a talk about words, because words are important. Words make you think. When you hear a word, you think about it. There's a little spark somewhere in the brain, a little neuron that fires when it hears its name. But what happens if there isn't a name for something? Then how is that neuron going to spark? How are you going to think about something if you don't have a word for it? And in the patriarchy, there are some things they want us to think about all the time, but not very clearly. That's the first L word we're going to talk about. And then there's other things they don't want us to think about at all, so they try not to have a word for it. And that's the second L word. So are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
All right. I'm going to give you two examples of how this works. The patriarchy loves words about romance and sex because that's one of the ways that they suck women into the heteropatriarchy. So everybody knows the word date and everybody knows the word sexual, and those words are just fine and dandy. Now, before the 1970s, people weren't putting the word date together with rape, and they didn't put the word sexual together with harassment. You absolutely never heard those terms, nor did you read about them. Did that mean they weren't happening to women and hadn't been happening and happening and happening to a lot of women for about 200,000 years? No. Well, then why were there no terms for it? And it's because the patriarchy didn't want us to have a name for what they were doing to us. Because if we couldn't name it, we couldn't frame it. And if we couldn't frame it, we couldn't get laws passed to protect ourselves. And that meant they could go on doing it to us as much as they wanted. And because, in everybody's mind, a date is supposed to be voluntary, a lot of people thought there couldn't be such thing as a date rape. they would say, well, she must have changed her mind later, or maybe she was jealous. And because sexual is supposed to be pleasant, there couldn't be sexual harassment. And they would say, well, it's just a case of teasing a woman who had no sense of humor. Why did it take 200,000 years to name date rape and sexual harassment? Because it takes power to name things, and women have been slow, mighty slow, to take that power. But in the 1960s, we had a movement, and that means we were moving together, and we were moving a pile of shit. And that's a good thing. We had a movement, and that movement had power, and we named ourselves, and we said we were sisters, and we were lesbians, and we named the patriarchy, and we started doing it for ourselves. And today, date rape and sexual harassment are crimes because of that movement. They are crimes. You can put a date rapist in jail. You can get paid millions of dollars in damages from big corporations for sexual harassment today. Why? Because we learned to make those connections in the 1960s. All right, so we're going to talk about these L words today. And the first one is one that you hear way too much of, and some of you have probably already figured it out, and yes, it's love. And we just love to say that word, don't we? We just love Melissa Ferrick, and we just love Tracy Chapman, and we just love burritos, and we just love that song, and we just love this book, and we love the weather, we love this house, we love you. We love the way you smile, we love the way you smell, we love, 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 love the way you touch us, and we love, and we love, and we love, and we love, and I'm just getting worn out just saying that word. Love is a tired word. It is overworked. It's a word that's expected to do too many things. It's a word that's supposed to be too many places at once. Now, what happens to people when we have too many things to do and too many places to be? We end up not doing anything very well and hardly ever being where we should be. And that is exactly what's happening to our love today. Now, I want to tell you about Suzette Hayden Elgin. Suzette Hayden Elgin was a writer. She understood words, as Tony Bamber would say. She understood them as acts of language. She wrote a book called The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense, which is a powerful tool for women, all about how the patriarchy uses its language against us. She wrote another book, a science fiction book called Native Tongue. And in Native Tongue, Suzette Hayden Elgin writes about a community of women in the future. It's a science fiction book. And they have invented their own language called Layadin. And Layadin is a language that is all about making powerful connections. So right now I'm going to give you just a little lesson in Layadin, this science fiction language of women, one that is devised to help women. I'm going to read you a list of words in Layadin and what they mean. And I want you to think while I do this about somebody in your life that you say you love. Love, love, love. Okay, here we go. These are 11 different words in Layadin, and in our language, they would all mean the same thing, love. Okay, first one is Aaya, meaning a mysterious love, not yet known to be welcome or unwelcome. Second one is Aaj, love for one sexually desired at one time, but not now. Ab, love for one liked, but not respected. Odd, love for one respected, but not liked. Love for one related by blood. Ashan, love for one not related by blood, but kin of the heart. Aya, love that is unwelcome and a burden. Aj, love for one sexually desired now. Eemi, love for one neither liked nor respected. Oham, love for that which is holy. And sham, love for the child of one's body, presupposing neither liking nor respecting nor their absence. Now, hearing those words, you really had to think about the nature of the relationship. You had to go deep. You couldn't just skate by on, oh, I love you. You had to make connections with the heart, with the clit, with your history, and with your head. And if you're talking about love in Layadin, you have to be fully present. Now, I wonder why the English language is so vague about the word that is going to describe our most intense emotional relationships. We have more vocabulary for real estate transactions than we do for our intimate relationships. Why is that? Well, it's because the patriarchy wants to be precise in real estate transactions because that facilitates ownership. For the same reason, the patriarchy wants to be vague in relationship language because that also facilitates ownership. And I think you know what I'm talking about. Because when a word is vague, our thinking is vague. And when our thinking is vague, we don't make clear decisions, and we especially don't make clear decisions to protect ourselves. And the patriarchy does not want women to know how to protect ourselves. And the same thing is going on with sex. Like having sex. What does that mean? Do you feel like having sex tonight? Because sex can be a treat, a comfort, a gift, an enhancement, a bonding activity, a spiritual experience, a reward, a pleasure, an exploration, an adventure, a recreational activity, a payoff, a bribe, a diversion, an annoyance, a performance, a duty, a chore, an obsession, a compulsion, an addiction, a habit, a distraction, an appeasement, a trauma, an invasion, a violation, a punishment, or an ordeal, and a nightmare. So when somebody says, honey, how do you feel? Okay, so here's a scenario. Honey, do you feel like having a distraction tonight? Oh, well, it's kind of a chore, but I can probably come up with some kind of performance. Now, then you know exactly what you're talking about. That's a lot more precise than you feel like having sex, sure. And that's what it would sound like if we were being precise with these words. Precision. It's very difficult to brainwash and manipulate a woman who's insisting on precision. All right, so that's the first L word, and we need to break it down. We need to think critically about it because it's a one-size-fits-all word, which means it doesn't fit anybody. And we all deserve a custom fit in our relationships. Yes, we do. So the next time you want to say you love something, take a minute and see if you can be a little more precise. So what's the second L word? And don't even try to guess because probably half of you never heard of it and the rest of you never think about it. But before we talk about it, I have to tell you that you might want to brace yourselves, put on your seatbelts, because this word's going to make us shift paradigms. And a paradigm is nothing but a model for thinking. That's all it is. But when you shift paradigms, you have to shift the whole way your thinking works. It's just like the way people used to think the sun circled around the earth. And, of course, that's what they thought, and why wouldn't they? They could stick their head out the window in the morning and see the sun come up over the horizon. They could look up during the day and see it going across the sky. And at night, they could see it disappearing down the other side of the horizon. But then Galileo showed up, and he said, actually, no, the earth is circling around the sun. And it blew people's minds. It meant that we weren't the center of the universe anymore. It meant the universe did not revolve around us. Some of us actually still think that. And for a lot of people, it wrecked their relationship to their higher power. So they arrested Galileo and forced him to admit he was wrong. But you know what? The sun still revolved around the earth like it always had. My point is a paradigm shift can be uncomfortable, so buckle up. Okay, so what's the second L word? It's limerence. Limerence. And limerence is the name for a chemical high in the brain that you get when you are infatuated. Limerence describes a chemical high. It refers to an altered state. Now, what is an altered state? It's a state where the brain chemistry has been changed, either temporarily or permanently. And what happens when the brain chemistry changes? We think differently. We do not think the way we normally would. We don't perceive reality the same way. We don't process information the way we do when we're not in an altered state. Time moves differently. Our personalities may change. Things that used to seem important may seem trivial or ridiculous. Things we never cared about or never noticed may seem fascinating or earth-shaking. And here's the point. We make strange decisions under the influence of limerence. And something has to happen to trigger it. Well, what is it? It may be the magical click when your hands accidentally touch or your eyes meet across the crowded room. But that magic is not really all that magical. And when you say it feels like I've known you all my life, there's more truth to that than you know. Here's the deal. Our subconscious mind is already primed to look for someone we think, important point, we think, is going to give us back something we lost when we were children. Now, maybe we were well-behaved little girls and we've just met the daredevil who's going to walk us on the wild side. Or maybe we grew up poor or uncared for and we just met a generous and caregiving woman who's going to be our new mommy. Or maybe we never felt like anybody needed us and we have found a woman who is such a train wreck that there's no way she's ever going to leave us. Or maybe, and this is a sorry truth, pay attention to this, maybe we grew up in fear, like in an alcoholic home, and we found someone we're scared of, but we're sure that this time we can win them over, prove ourselves, or who knows what. Here's a new term for you, eroticizing anxiety. Eroticizing anxiety. Build a connection there. Build a synapse. Eroticizing anxiety. There are more women who do that than you might believe. Maybe even your girlfriend. So there's that magic click, that glance, that little thrill of danger. Whatever it is, something sets us off and our brain begins to produce a cocktail of drugs, specifically three of them, dopamine, norepinephrine, and one called B-phenylethylamine. And what do these chemicals do in the brain? Well, they do a lot of things. They speed up the synapsing like amphetamines or cocaine. They get the adrenaline going, the heart racing. They keep us from sleeping, keep us from eating, keep us from focusing on anything except the object of our attraction. They give us energy, confidence. They elevate our mood. They make us feel good, really, really good. And here's something else interesting that happens in the brain. When we are indulging in this chemical cocktail, the level of serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, gets very low, exactly as low as it is in the brains of people who have obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now, isn't that interesting? Because some of us, when we fall in love, obsess on the other person and become sexually compulsive. Why, you could almost say that falling in love is a form of mental illness. The scientists are not saying that exactly, but they are saying that this chemical cocktail of dopamine, norepinephrine, and B-phenylethylamine is addictive. It overstimulates the neurons, too much synapsing, and the poor little neuron can't deal with it, so it shuts down a bunch of receptor sites. And that's fine as long as you stay high. But as soon as the brain stops producing these chemicals, there's trouble, because the neurons find they can't reopen the receptor sites that easily. So now there's huge understimulation, and it feels like hell, psychologically and physically. It's called withdrawal, and it's just like drug and alcohol withdrawal. It makes people try to do anything they can think of to get more of the drug. They start telephoning 6 times a day. They start writing 10-page love letters, leaving notes. They write poems, love songs. They may start stalking. They may do something violent. Then maybe they start cruising the personals. Or they start going to the bars, or they find some other way to get high. Maybe they go cold turkey. But what I'm saying is that limerence is a chemical high, and the primary relationship you're having is with the chemicals in your own brain, not the other person, which is kind of like saying the earth goes around the sun, but you know what? It does. And there's more, and I know you don't want to hear this either, but it's true. Every time we have sex, our brains produce another drug called oxytocin, which makes us bond with our sex partner. Even if we met them 5 minutes ago, we're both drunk, they have a wife and kids back home, and they live on another continent. If we had sex with them, we're going to have that oxytocin in our brains, and we are going to feel we have a cosmic karmic bond and our soulmates. And here's another thing I know you don't want to hear, but it's still true. There's another chemical, vasopressin, that keeps us in long-term relationships. How? It suppresses the pathways for dopamine and norepinephrine, the chemicals of limerence. In other words, passion fades as attachment grows. So you might want to think about that the next time you're considering shelling out big bucks for a therapist who says she can help you put the passion back in your long-term relationship. Because according to brain chemistry, you cannot have your monogamous cake and eat it, if you know what I'm saying. So why do our brains do this to us? Why do they make us fall in love with idiots and cheat on our beloved long-term partners? Because we're animals. Yes, we are. We're animals, and animals are hardwired for survival of the species. We're hardwired to mate. And this chemically induced high is an incentive for us to do that. And guess what? Limerence will last about 2 years, which is long enough for a woman to mate, get pregnant, have the baby, and wean it. It's long enough to ensure the survival of the mother and the infant when they're most vulnerable. Limerence doesn't know we're not cave women anymore. Instead of raising little Neanderthals, we are quitting our jobs, moving across the country, giving up all our friends, taking up hobbies we used to think were stupid, all for the sake of someone who turns out to be a complete psycho. Limerence is betraying us as individuals for the greater good of the species. And I'm going to say it again. Limerence is an altered state designed to get you to mate. That's what it is. Limerence does not care too much who it is you mate with. So you have to be smarter than your limerence. And that's not easy because limerence feels so good. Yes, it does. It feels wonderful. It feels like love. It feels like having the goddess come right down into the bed with you. It feels like it cancels out all the heartache and all the failures and disappointments you've had in your whole life. It levels the debt the world owes you. It makes up for your rotten childhood. You can forgive everybody, even your mother, because you've just won the happily ever after lottery. Nothing can ever hurt you again if you can hold on to this person forever and ever. But that's the wrong if, because the real if is if you can just keep producing the brain chemicals of limerence forever. And that's not possible unless you manage to keep falling in love over and over and over and over again about every 2 years. Or if you can't do that, you read lesbian romance novels or cheesy movies. If they'll deliver a little mini limerence drug that can tide you over. So limerence is chemically altered state of the brain. What do you do if you go to a party and get yourself into an altered state and then you need to go home? Well, what do? You give your keys to a friend, don't you? A sober friend. And why do you do that? Because you know you're in an altered state and you cannot trust your judgment or your perceptions, and somebody, even you, could get hurt. Now, if you're in limerence and you're starting to think about having sex with that person or moving in with them or co-signing a loan or marrying them, ask your friends to help you out with your thinking. Have them get to know your new girlfriend. Ask them to tell you the truth. See if they think it's a good idea to have her move in with you or for you to fly over to Timbuktu every month to be with her. Ask for their advice and then take it. And if you are the friend she, your friend, is asking, don't be such a romance junkie that you encourage her. She's trusting you to stay sober. She's asking you to help her make a sound connection. Don't be so happy to see her in limerence you disconnect your brain. Break it down, sister, break it down. Because what we're talking about here is the R word, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to you. So we've talked about two L words, love and limerence. And love is just too generic, pie in the sky, moon in June, to be helpful. And limerence is too clinical to give us hope. So what are we going to do? We're going to respect ourselves and we're going to respect each other. We're going to be specific about what we're feeling when we say we love someone so we can be responsible and accountable. And we're going to get a second opinion and a designated driver who are in the thrall of limerence so we don't run our lives off the road. Remember, it's all about respect. Blessed be.
Carolyn, that's just fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
That's just fabulous. In part, took me back to other times I've heard you read, and I just loved how you put all of that together. And some of it goes back to really what I teach people from a dating coach perspective, because I teach people that all those feelings are drugs. They're drugs. Please be aware. Drugs are dangerous.
Yeah, and it's hard because I find that in lesbian community, well, the popular culture, you listen to songs on the radio or you see these movies, and they're always trying to get you to think limerence is love. And I think that that fuels consumerism, and I also think it makes people less likely to be politically disgruntled and troublemakers and revolutionaries. I think there's a politic to this conflating limerence with love. I think it's not an accident. I think it's intentional. And we have to kind of, we're up against the whole culture, I think, when we're trying to think clearly about these things.
Well, I agree. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars that's made on the romance of love as, really, as we can understand it out of, you know, your reading today, that really is about that limerence, that chemical high. I mean, and it is. You've said it a number of times. It's like, it feels great. Wow, it feels great.
I know.
Wow.
I know. And then a lot of women, and then they feel that when it's wearing off that they've made a mistake or that the terminology, the love has died. It's like, no, it really wasn't there to begin with. That was an artificial high, and now you're dealing with reality. And so I think sometimes women walk away from relationships too soon because they're confused about that.
Yeah, and we haven't, as a society, been taught, I think, how to really sustain a relationship past that whole limerence stage, because we want that limerence. We want that drug. You know, you talked about the that it really is like going through withdrawal from alcohol or some kind of addictive drug when it starts to fade, and it's like, I want my drug. And,
well, I thought it so fascinating that there's a biology to that, that literally, you know, they can look at the brain and see these receptor sites and these chemicals, and they're not there. And it's identical to a drug withdrawal. I just find that fascinating, and it does give me a little more compassion for the women who stalk, you know, that they're not aware of what's driving them, you know, but
right.
must have drug, you know.
I must have my drug, and you are my drug.
Yeah.
But I also like that, you know, we could listen to your reading and come to the end of it and go, well, I might as well just get a gun and shoot myself. What am I doing? What am I looking for? What's the point of even trying to have a relationship? And that there are all kinds of important reasons to have a relationship and to really believe that, that the value and the importance of a committed, strong relationship is, you know, far beyond all kinds of other things. It's more valuable than all the stuff you can have and all the money in the bank and the titles you have or the awards that you've been given, but to know that there's somebody who's committed to you and loves you and accepts you unconditionally is a really big thing. And in Limerence, we're not accepting somebody unconditionally. I love how you put it. It's like we're really being in love with ourselves. We're doing this thing to ourselves. It's the chemicals in our own brain. And it's just sort of like that person, that woman we're looking at who we think is all it. It's just like she's a mirror and it's just bouncing back to us. We're not even really seeing into her. And you're sort of like three steps, you know. So what do you do? You know, limerence shows up. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't respond to it, but it does mean you need to have some sort of boundaries or checkpoints in place that help you make a great decision, a much better decision than just the, oh, my God, I've been waiting for you forever. You're the perfect fulfillment to me. You make me complete. You're everything.
Well,
I
also
wanted.
Think, you know, the great myth, of course, of the West is individualism, and we know that's a lie, the self-made man,
mm-hmm.
you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also
right.
the self-made relationship, and that's why I stress, you know, that, you know, have a team and have a team vet her. You know, if your close friends are all telling you, doesn't look good to me, and I've actually been in that situation, and in heavy limerence, you realize all your friends are mistaken.
Of course, they're all wrong.
They're not. You know, I will bet you 99% of the time, if you ask three or four of your friends and they spend time with your new girlfriend and they all return a negative verdict, they're probably right. You know,
yeah.
It's just hard
mm-hmm.
to hear it if you're wildly in love. But, I mean, I think that having a community or a kind of a posse of trusted friends, you know, the belief that it's just walking on the beach and sitting by the fireplace and all that, I think the stronger your friendships and the broader your community, the better you have a chance of making a go of a long-term relationship, because it's like a shock absorber. It's where you go when, you know, you're up against your partner and, you know, there's too much friction or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
I think they often leave that out. Like that's not in the romantic movie. And particularly when you see the rom-coms, generally the woman doesn't have very strong friendships with other women. She's just kind of hanging out there until Mr. Right comes along, you know. And
right.
she's
yeah.
greatly at risk when that happens.
Everything's revolving around him. And, you know, we're as guilty of that in the lesbian community. If everything's revolving around that perfect woman who's out there, if I can just find her. And, again, from my perspective as a dating coach, what you're saying is exactly one of the things that I coach women about is you've got to have your friends and your family involved. If, you know, they're supportive, they know you, they've been in your world for a long time. Make sure they're giving you, you know, some feedback about this woman that you're dating, this relationship that you're in. Is it really, from where they sit, do they see it working? Do they see this person as really being a good match for you? Do they see you as being a good match for that person. I mean, I've seen it both ways where my friend is like, I'm looking at her and like, you know, you're not actually very nice to her. Why are you seeing her? And then why is she putting up with that? And they're looking at me like, really? I'm like, yes, really.
Well, and you know, I got to say, Mary, there are not a lot of women that will say that, you know, to a friend. I mean, I think sometimes we're afraid and, you know, how many, you know, it's just like telling somebody you think they that maybe when what you see they have a problem with alcohol. In that moment, you're risking the whole friendship. And I think when you suggest that the partnership doesn't look healthy to you, or in your case, that you're telling them you actually feel that their behaviors might be the thing in question, it puts the friendship on the line. And I just think that takes a real friend to do that. A lot of people don't want to put themselves out there like that. You know,
yeah,
they probably feel like, well, if she has to choose between me and the girlfriend, or me and the drink or whatever, we know how that's going to go. And so I think that's wonderful that you encourage that kind of honesty and that you practice it yourself. That's really important.
Well, I do try to. I can say that, you know, it's not a conversation I can just casually have with anybody I know. It really is about those friendships where there's somebody who I know well. I know that we are good friends. We've helped each other through a lot of hard times and thick and thin, and we have stayed connected in each other's lives for a long time for that, because we really care and love each other in real ways. And those are the places where I feel I have a responsibility to say, I'm just speaking my truth. I recognize that you may not agree with this at all, but that's mm-hmm. not a good thing there. And I want my friends to be able to say that to me.
And I think that when you do say things like that to people, it's kind of like the drinking problem conversation. You know, things may not go well in the moment, but that's not the last word. And maybe two more friends suggest the same thing, and then they see it. And sometimes, you know, I've had people come back to me years later and acknowledge, and it stuck in their mind. You know, they came back really defensive, and it looked like to me they just kind of didn't hear it, but it stuck in their mind. And then they reached some critical mass, and it's part of what is the tipping point. So I think that you can't judge the effectiveness of telling the truth to a friend by the immediate response. You don't know what kind of change, on what kind of timeline it's going to catalyze. But I do think it's important, and particularly if you feel like there's disrespect or even abuse going on, if you see something, say something. I think that that's what friends do.
Yeah. I think that's so valuable, and I'm really glad. It's one of the things that came up and out of your reading on love and limerence. Really, really beautiful. And, you know, sort of, you know, obviously you write out of, you know, both the research that you do, the history that you study, and your experience and your, you know, of your life and what's happened to you over the years. But if you were going to share sort of one of the big important lessons you've learned in life, you know, what would that be?
Well, actually, it's something that I think is from the Gnostic Gospels, and since I'm not a religious person, that's kind of odd, but it was something like, if you bring forth that which is within you, it will save you. If you do not bring forth that which is within you, it will destroy you. And I am a survivor of child sexual abuse, but I think it has wider implications than that, but I believe that is the truth, and I believe that we are not as in control of our process as we think we are. And if you have deep secrets or hidden trauma, it will really drive the bus, whether you think it is or not. I really feel that that's who's really pulling the strings. I think you do need to get out, you know, in some way through art or some kind of sharing what is inside you. Get your truth out. And I really believe if you don't, it causes all kinds of physical problems and deformation of personality, dissociative disorder that I think we see in so many of the corporate leaders and the politicians. It's like they're lying and they don't even seem to know they're lying, you know, and I think it's just too much being split off from your own truth for too long. I think that's really, really important. And this culture does not make it easy for you either to access your truth or to express it. You have to make that a priority, because it's not going to happen otherwise. There's too many forces in play that are perfectly happy to have you shut up and numb out. That's the path of least resistance. But as Alice Walker says, resistance is the secret of joy. So resisting those mainstream pressures seems like it's political hard work. It's really not. To me, it is the essence of the joy of being a lesbian.
I like that. So Carolyn, we're coming up to the end of our time here, and I know you wanted, you have a book that I just wanted to talk a little bit about. Carolyn has a book. It's called Like There's No Tomorrow, Meditations for Women Leaving Patriarchy. And I got a copy of this book about 10, 12 years ago. It's a really wonderful book. It's a daily meditation book, fully indexed, written with a light touch, but deeply political, as Carolyn is. It's a daily reader for those of us in search of radical healing, and it really is a beautiful and special book. You can purchase it in paperback and ebook. I love ebooks. And there's a URL that you can use to go to get that, and that's called liveyourbestlesbianlife.com/Carolyn, and Carolyn spells her name Carolyn. Carolyn, I want to thank you so much for taking time out to be with us to read that really beautiful piece on love and limerence. I love it. It just so speaks to what I think is true about how we misunderstand both love and limerence and how it impacts our lives. It's really beautiful and wonderful to be with you here today.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was a privilege to share it, and I think this whole program that you've put together, it sounds absolutely remarkable, and thank you for beginning to build this worldwide lesbian community, and I hope everyone listening in today will take advantage of all the other incredible speakers that you've lined up, as well as supporting your work.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn, so much. You know, as we close out today's call, I want to thank Carolyn for being here and sharing not only your work, but, you know, what keeps you motivated and the work you do, because you really are focused on making a difference. Live Your Best Lesbian Life Telesummit is about us making a difference for each other and making these resources, these amazing women available, as Carolyn just said. This event goes through June 27th, and I want to invite you to visit us on Facebook, get involved in the conversation as we talk about how we can each live our best lesbian life, and you can find us at Live Your Best Lesbian Life on Facebook. And so join us there. Be part of the conversation. You'll see some of our speakers out there over the course of the next couple of weeks who are maybe just dropping in to see what kind of conversation is going on. And be here again with us for the next call happening this evening. All the information is in the email which you got this morning. So, again, thank you all. Thank you, Carolyn. And everybody, have your best day today. Take care. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.